This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to JS on Politics, our weekly look at what's happening in Madison, state government, and local political issues. I'm your host, Greg Borowski. Now, things may have slowed down a bit in Madison this week in terms of the budget, but they haven't on our show. So let's go through our list of what we're going to be talking about. We'll begin with a look at where education issues stand in the state budget, as well as some disagreements that have lawmakers all tied up. Meanwhile, some other issues, including a 20-week abortion ban, have moved to Governor Walker's desk. Even if he's so busy traveling, he might not be there every day to sign it. And then finally, we'll look at the rise of Chris Abele. Remember him. And of course, we'll take some reader questions at the end. But we're going to start with education and with Aaron Richards. So you had a story this morning in the newspaper and online about, you know, where all these issues stand. You know, the lower education, K-12, got a lot of the funding restored, but there seem to be all these other issues that are troubling folks in education.
Right. Yeah. It's certainly been a contentious package of education proposals pushed by the GOP. You know, the public school folks have really risen up and sort of opposed a lot of the changes in the budget. But what the Republicans are saying is, look, we gave you the $127 million back that Walker had proposed cutting in the second year of the budget. Now, they did that alongside proposing the expansion of the statewide voucher program and putting some other things in the budget, like special needs vouchers. So you're really seeing the public school communities rise up and say, we have to continue to fight this. But the Republicans, who control the legislature, haven't signaled that there's much wiggle room on anything but one proposal about teacher training.
But, you know, one thing is, Governor Walker pays attention to these things. And frequently, when people insert things into the budget, the Republicans don't respond. It hasn't happened that way in the past, but then Walker comes in at the last second with a veto. So when these groups are lobbying and trying to get these things out of the budget, you need to remember that it might not just have an impact on Voss and Fitzgerald, but Walker's in the background and can knock these things out if he doesn't think they are good.
Let's bring in Jason Stein from our Madison Bureau. So a lot of these issues that are currently on the table, and we're talking about, you know, expansion of private school choice, you know, more chartering, these takeover of poor MPS schools, these are things that were inserted by the lawmakers. Do you have a sense, Jason, about what the governor supports or doesn't support, or is he going to just sort of accept most of what's sent forward to him?
The governor typically does end up supporting most of the things that are inserted in the budget by his own party, because obviously they're not doing that in a vacuum. I mean, they're talking with him and his people as they're putting these things in. I mean, it doesn't mean he supports every one of them, but they're typically just not going to throw something into the state budget, his state budget, without at least running it past him. You know, that being said, he's going to veto some of these things for sure. I think particularly as he runs as a conservative in the Republican primary for the White House, you know, undeclared candidate, he is going to be looking for what are some vetoes that can really burnish my credentials as a conservative. So particularly anything that would introduce new spending or that sort of thing could have a veto bullseye on it.
Well, let's, Aaron, you've covered education for many years now. Talk about, so assume that most of these things are going to go through, right? Some might get vetoed or trimmed or shaved a little bit by the governor, but what's the headline then at the end of the budget? What has happened to education? Who's running education policy? And we've gone rightward, of course, but what are the big takeaways for people?
Well, I think the power has really shifted, and what you're seeing is there's been a Republican appetite to send more public money to private or at least independent school options that don't have to answer to a school board in the name of increasing efficiencies and increasing innovation. And I think that's where you're going to see the power really shift. I mean, this whole budget has really focused on kind of reducing districts' impact a little bit. And in the long run, if some of these options are expanded, it will, in the long run, reduce some of their funding as well. What the sentiment is that districts will sort of rise up and compete against these options. It's a little too early to tell what kind of effect that's going to have on, you know,
there was one group that I was interested in that you didn't mention in today's story, and that is, in the past, it's mainly been a fight between Republicans and the teachers union. And it's not so much the teachers union this time, it's parent groups, districts, superintendents, other groups who are stepping in because of the reduced power of WEAC in the state. Do you think it's true?
Yeah, you're absolutely seeing some of these groups rise up, sort of in the vacuum that's been left by unions that aren't as mobile anymore. They don't have as many dues payments coming in to support this kind of work. So you really saw at the beginning of the budget not too many other people filling that void, and sort of late in the game here, you're really seeing parents groups rise up all over the state and sort of be a more vocal presence, and superintendents kind of doing the same thing, standing up and actually trying to, you know, be a little bit more vocal about these things.
I'm going to slip in a couple of reader questions we got today on the education issues. I'm going to throw this one first to Jason. This question is from UW1980, who asks, are there any Republicans in the state Senate who are against expanding vouchers and taking over MPS? And what are the possibilities of a pro-public education Republican running against Senator Vukmir and others? What's your sense? Or is that particular aspect pretty well universally supported by Republicans, or is there some opposition on the expansion of the voucher program?
Well, voucher advocates are certainly one of the most powerful parts of the Republican Party right now. You know, a lot of money behind them, and also, you know, a lot of Republicans ideologically really like the voucher school approach and arguments. As always, you're looking at rural Republicans, rural lawmakers to see who may have school districts who are already being squeezed because of, you know, declines in student enrollment out there and things like that in the rural parts of the state. So that's always going to be the group that you're going to look to that's going to be the response. Now, there's been some changes to how voucher schools would be funded in those areas, you know, statewide funding of the program. And so, you know, one thing that we're still kind of looking at, I think, to a certain extent, is how does that change the calculus? Because it's always about how much money is going away from public schools in my district to private schools, and how do my constituents feel about that?
I think the district to watch is actually Senator Vukmir's. She's a very strong proponent of school choice, and the special needs provision in the budget is one that she's been pushing for years. At the same time, the superintendent and the parents have become very active in Wauwatosa, and it's leading to this eventual clash between the public school forces and her ideological support for school choice.
All right, let's shift and talk about the budget. So by my clock, we have, as of this moment, 19 days, 11 hours, and about 52 minutes till the budget expires.
Seconds? How many seconds?
I can't, so the seconds go a little too fast, Dan. Come on, I got the first part calculated out. So what's the risk here that this budget doesn't get done on time, or that it's just a massive chaos at the end?
I think of this as like you're at work and you have this huge project that you have that you're supposed to get done, and instead of doing it, you do all of these other little things.
We've never experienced that in our newsroom.
It doesn't even have to be your newsroom. It could be school. You've got a school project, and you end up doing all these fun other stuff and avoid the big issue. I mean, that seems to be what's going on in Madison
right now. It
also
doesn't seem like there's a hard cap on when we actually have to finish this
thing.
Like, there's kind of a moving deadline. So it's like stuff kind of just keeps
going. It's been as late as October since when they pass a budget. But it's supposed to be by the end of the month of June.
So, Jason, does it get done by the end of June, or are we drifting into July and further on?
My sense is it doesn't get done. I mean, the one caveat is that whenever you have a budget deal, when you're the legislative leaders, man, you want to get that thing done like that, because you're concerned about, once you have people saying they'll vote for it, getting those people getting flipped. But it really doesn't look like it'll get done. As Dan said, it's not really a hard and fast deadline, because the state just keeps operating under the current budget. So it's not like the federal government, where if they don't pass something, you know, everybody shuts down and it's really chaotic. It's not like that.
Well, what, in your assessment, maybe Jason and Dana, what is transportation the biggest holdup now? Or is it that they've sort of put together a budget in voting on all these separate measures that people aren't as supportive of than, you know, than the way it came through?
It's a combination of those two things, Greg. I mean, on the one hand, it's just a tough budget all around. You know, the university is getting cut by $250 million over 2 years. You know, public schools are not particularly happy. And then there's this big disagreement in particular on transportation and to a lesser extent, a couple other issues like how to fund an arena for the Milwaukee Bucks. So it's sort of a
the lesser
general
issue.
yeah, it's sort of a general unease about the overall budget and then just really wide differences on a couple big issues.
Right. Well, it seems like you might have, if you take these issues independently, you might have easily majority support on them, but would you sort of mix and match and put them together as this final version that gets
And when
problem.
He says big differences on these issues, he's not talking about differences between Republicans and Democrats. He's saying within the right. Republican community that there's a question of how much road construction we're going to do and how we're going to pay for it. And on the Bucks arena, you know, there's a growing number of Republican senators who aren't fond of the package that they put together. And complicating that is no one's seen any actual legislation or bill except for a few people behind the scenes. So it's hard to put that in the budget bill when the people who are being asked to vote on it haven't even seen it.
All right. Well, as we mentioned before, other things are getting done in moving forward in Madison. There was a vote this week on dropping the 24-hour waiting period for a handgun purchase, the pass of the 20-week abortion ban, abortions after 20 weeks. So, Jason, let me ask you this one to start this segment here. Do either of these, on a practical basis, have much effect, or are these more, you know, sort of ideological things sure. that are being pushed forward?
I think on the guns proposal, there is a practical effect for consumers that, you know, you're going to be able to buy these more quickly than you could before. And then, you know, the debate is obviously going to be over whether there's a public safety impact to that as well. On the abortion side, it's really less clear to me right now. I mean, that's one of the questions that I would really like to get solved. I mean, right now, there is no abortion clinic in the state that provides the procedure at this point in time that's been banned by lawmakers. And what we're trying to figure out is to what extent sometimes this procedure gets performed out in hospitals in cases of you know, medical problems for the mother or the fetus.
Okay. Well,
it's interesting that these things are going on against the backdrop of Governor Walker running for president, because he's come under criticism recently from the Christian right for not pushing these issues hard enough, particularly abortion and same-sex marriage. And so while he's running, he's got his legislature pushing these things, which might be a good thing because he gets to sign off on these, but some on the Christian right have raised the question of why weren't these things brought up earlier. Of course, his perspective is he was focused on economic issues and things like that, but while everybody is, you know, everything's locked down on the budget bill and those financial issues, Republicans found it much easier to come together on these social issues.
Right. Patrick, I'm sorry, I'm talking about a story that Patrick did, so I'm talking to Jason. I've done this once before, and I apologize. But Jason, Patrick, we had a story that posted from him this morning on the alternative minimum tax and some changes there. Now, most people might hear minimum tax and kind of like it, but give us a sense of who this would impact.
It doesn't apply to us.
It doesn't apply to us. Darn, we can go to the next segment.
I like being confused with Patrick. I've been coasting on that guy's credentials for years, so I'll just keep doing that. As far as the AMT, you know, this is a proposal, a tax that primarily applies to, you know, well-off people, people who might make, you know, $300,000 a year. It's a relatively small number of people, but it has been growing a lot in recent years. And, you know, some Republicans are saying, yes, we are cutting a lot of things. We're cutting things like the university, but we would still like to simplify the tax code and remove this tax on wealthy folks. And so that will be interesting to see what their colleagues say about that.
Dan, do you think that's something that people be able to resist and throw another thing onto this, you know, budget, or is that something that, you know, might become problematic?
You know, I was surprised at the lack of reaction to the story today so far. That you know, people are not going to gauge this based on this particular vote. What people end up reacting to is how's the economy doing? And that's the question. Is this something that helps the economy or hurts the economy? And when it comes to time for the election, that's the issue that people are thinking about.
Okay. All right. So Scott Walker has said he won't announce a presidential campaign until after the budget is over. So I just want each of you quickly give me a prediction on a date that Scott Walker announces his presidential bid.
Jason, somebody, you can go first.
Jason, go first.
Can we bet on this?
Oh, that's good.
I don't
that's
think we
can. You pop the question and then you immediately throw it over to Madison. I don't know, middle of July.
Mid-July. Aaron, what do you think?
I'm going to say August 1.
I was going to say August 1, but August is so dead. Yeah, I mean, there's not much of an audience right there. People are on vacation. You've got Bush making the announcement this week. I'm going to go closer with Jason. I'm going to say July 22nd.
Okay, we're going to hold everybody to that, and right now we're going to go to a tape segment with Craig Gilbert from Washington Bureau talking about the Walker's presidential campaign. We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau chief, to talk about how Scott Walker is doing on the presidential front. Now, Craig, as you know, Walker's got another busy travel schedule this week, and he's also got problems in Madison with getting the budget done. He's sort of starting to remind me of the guy in the circus who spins plates. And how does he keep them all going? What's your sense of how he's managing that back and forth between the state issues and the presidential campaign?
Well, it is a juggling act. I think he's managing, not without some problems and not without some potential bumps down the road. He's got a really aggressive travel schedule. He's spending the end of this week at a Mitt Romney-sponsored retreat for Republican candidates in Utah, and then he's off to Canada for several days on official business as governor. And then after that, he resumes his political travels. I think this is frustrating to some legislators because there's some really thorny issues that have to be worked out in the budget. And meanwhile, the governor won't be announcing his presidential campaign until that happens. He's going to end up announcing later than a lot of us anticipated. You know, it looks like it could be the end of June, beginning of July, or even potentially after the 4th of July if things go on long enough.
Yeah, well, as we saw with the arena deal, things, you know, sometimes don't happen until the governor's in the room. I mean, is there any real substitute for that? They talk about cell phones and email,
right.
but you need the person there to sort of cut the final deal, don't you?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I was with the governor on a sunset cruise sponsored by the Belknap County Republican Party in New Hampshire, the very same moment when the Joint Finance Committee was hashing out all these really difficult budget issues, and it didn't necessarily look good. I asked the governor about that, and he said, you know, he's in touch as much as he would be if he were there, but it's hard to believe you can have the same effect from a distance. As you would if you were in the room. And also there's just sort of the perception that you can't be as engaged when you're trying to do this very big other thing, which is run for president.
Right. Now, we've talked, and you mentioned just before about the governor's timeline for announcing it was going to be after the budget. So it's probably later right now than he would have anticipated. Is there a practical ramification to that because of the way he's set up his campaign funds, or is this just as well for him? You managed to just sort of
roll
merrily along.
You know, one of the reasons for delaying, aside from the budget, is that there are some, it's helpful in some ways, given the way the campaign finance rules are being enforced. The two candidates that have really been delaying their announcements are Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. And they've both been criticized for that by some campaign finance experts and because you're allowed essentially to do more coordinating with these so-called independent groups that are raising tons of unlimited money for you on your behalf. You're allowed to do more of that, have more engagement with them and coordination with them if you're not officially a candidate. A lot of people see this as a kind of a fiction that these two are actually not running for president yet, when in fact, you know, they have all the trappings of a presidential campaign. So that is a little bit of an issue. It's Jeb Bush has gotten a lot more criticism for this than Scott Walker because Jeb Bush is raising a lot more money ostensibly than Scott Walker, but they're both, I think, open to the same questions about this notion that they're not really running for president yet.
So, Craig, let me ask you about the governor's appearance on this past Sunday on ABC News. One of the trappings of the presidential campaign is the candidates and would-be candidates go on the talk shows, and the reporters try to trap the candidates into an issue and a statement of real clarity. Talk a little bit about what the governor said about ISIS and boots on the ground in Iraq.
Well, the governor's been very hawkish about foreign policy, about taking on America's enemies. He's been very critical of the Obama administration, accusing them of being soft and not doing enough and not being aggressive enough. But as a result, I mean, he's kind of invited questions about how far he would go militarily. He's avoided being very specific about that. He's made the argument that you shouldn't rule anything out. So he gets the kinds of questions he got, like the ones he got on ABC in this interview, where would you rule out military force? Would you rule out boots on the ground? Would you rule out a full-blown reinvasion of Iraq? And, in reality, he's not ruling anything out. So people reading those exchanges are kind of invited to think whatever they want to about how eager or not the governor would be to use military force. But it's kind of emblematic of this another balancing act he has. We've talked about some of these juggling acts of his, and when you're sounding as hawkish as he is, and you've decided that this is an avenue of argument against Democrats, then I think you have to be careful about coming across as overeager to use military force. That's clearly doesn't appear to poll very well. And when, again, the last time I was on the campaign trail with the governor, I noticed that he was starting to include in his talking points about foreign policy and the military that he, you know, phrases like, I don't want to be the world's policeman, I don't want to go in everywhere, I don't want any open-ended engagements, mixing that kind of rhetoric in with the tough talk.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
All right, we're back live now, and I want to talk with Dan Bice a bit about his story earlier this week on the ascendancy of Chris Abele as a political player. He's, of course, the Milwaukee County executive. Tell us a little bit, Dan, about what, has anything surprised you about that he became sort of the linchpin in some of this, or a key person to put this deal together for the Bucks arena?
It's somewhat interesting because he's actually been the furthest out of the spotlight. And it's against the backdrop of other things that he's done. He's enhanced his power as county exec, and if the budget bill goes through as it is, he'll be able to help run or select someone to run five failing Milwaukee public schools. So he's expanded his power, and with the Bucks Arena, he's done that even more. He's definitely has put his imprint on it. If you look at the things that he's done, one, he's responsible for putting together a super board that would merge many of the entertainment venues under one jurisdiction. He's also trying to sell the property to around the Park East for a dollar. He also has agreed to certify their debt, which allows the state to collect their debt, $80 million worth of debt over the next 20 years. And then he's talking about adding some additional reforms, which would give him even more power as county exec.
You can. Well, he's more powerful, would you say, than Scott Walker was as county executive?
Oh, yeah. He certainly enhanced the power. The position today is a much more powerful position than it was before. And part of that is that there's been a shift of responsibilities from the county board to the county executive, and that's been intentional. You can look at how he's dealt with this, the Bucks Arena, and compare and contrast it with how Tom Barrett's done it. One has been very much on the offense, and the other one's been very much on defense. Abele, from the outset, wanted to get a deal done. And it, you know, for whatever reason, some people say because he's a huge NBA fan, some people say it's just because they need to develop Park East, but for whatever reason, and he started putting ideas on the table to get it done. Barrett, by contrast, has been very cautious and defensive on what he's done, and in the end, he ends up agreeing to build a parking structure and to do a tax incremental financing for $47 million. What's interesting about this is they're both up for election next year, and Barrett acted as if he's seriously facing some challenge, which he's not. But he's being very cautious to make sure there's no one on the right and no one on the left who's going to run against him. Abele, on the other hand, is you know, he put together this deal, which some people say is a risky deal for him, particularly the debt certification part.
he's acting as if he has no opposition, and maybe he won't have serious opposition.
He didn't last time, and Barrett had mostly token opposition. So do you see someone emerging with a strong, credible campaign against either one of them?
You know,
this time next year it'll be over.
Yeah, the one person everyone would love to see run for local office is Sheriff Clark, but he looks less and less like someone who's interested and engaged. He's focused eventually on getting something on Fox News or his own TV show. He's just recently started a national podcast. So after him, it falls off incredibly in terms of who would be willing to run against him. But I was talking to a Barrett person yesterday who was saying that he didn't accept this debt certification, which means going after deadbeats and poor people for debts that they owe to the city and to the county. And the city refused to do this because they were afraid if they did that they might have a campaign like the de Blasio campaign in New York, where someone runs hard to the left against Barrett. But who would do that? The name that they were tossing out there was Senator Lena Taylor, but Senator Taylor didn't do so well in the county execs race, and I don't think she's really a credible candidate. But so they were thinking in terms of potential candidates against them. But the concern with Chris Abele is he can self-fund a campaign, and so who wants to run against a guy who can write $1 million check to his own campaign?
Do you think someone on the county board might, just out of that ongoing,
you know, the members of the county board tend to be looking out for themselves, and so some of them are running for legislative positions, which will now pay better than theirs. And like Mark Borkowski is now running for alderman, a job that pays way better than what county board members. I don't see anybody right now seriously putting together a big campaign war chest to take him on.
Do you think Chris Abele has higher ambitions, and that he may want to run for something else someday, and this will help him in that regard?
You know, it's funny. When he first ran, he wanted his campaign committee to be Chris Abele for county exec, because he told people he would never run for anything else. And my understanding, and I wrote this, he was seriously thinking about running against Ron Johnson if Russ Feingold didn't get into the race. And I think if he's able to get all of this stuff done and the Bucks deal doesn't collapse around him, I think he's someone who would certainly like to run for governor eventually.
Okay. All right, let's take some reader questions now in our remaining few minutes here. So this question is from Answer This. So I guess that's kind of get our attention. We'll answer this. So the question is, when is someone going to force Walker to announce for president so he won't be able to raise unlimited money anymore? And didn't he promise to finish his term?
He did say he'd finish his term. He also said he was just weighing or thinking about running for president, but immediately shifted into that mode. So, again, he doesn't have to announce that he's running for president. Most of the people who've announced running for president so far are people who need the attention. And, you know, Jeb Bush is announcing this week, and, you know, he's actually run into some problems and had to refashion his staff and so forth. So he needs some positive energy, so he's announcing that he's running for office. Walker said he won't run until the budget bill's done, and he's pretty much stuck to that so far. If it stretches into mid to late July, I might see him changing his mind on that and making the announcement. But he hasn't had to announce because he's raising money. He's getting the headlines. People are very interested in reading about him, so there's no need for him to announce right now.
All right. This question's from Jim, who says simply, is Wisconsin ready for Governor Clayfish?
Or something. There's several hurdles before we get to Governor Clayfish, including, first of all, you got to get the governor to announce that he's running for president. Then he has to win a primary and then a general election. I would think the more interesting question isn't, is the state ready for Governor Clayfish? But assuming all of that happens, is Rebecca Clayfish ready to be governor? Is the bigger and a more important question.
All right, this question is from Ron, and we have a couple who will run through on the Bucks Arena. So this question is, why can't the building of a new Bucks Arena be placed on a ballot in a referendum question for voters in Milwaukee, Waukesha, Washington, or Racine County so that the people get to decide it? He says, I've not heard any of my friends or associates speak in favor of this project. But it won't be because it's too risky for the politicians, right? And they don't want to walk a shot.
They're afraid of what would happen.
Racine's not in the
mix. Do you remember what happened in Green Bay when they put it on the ballot? Brown County, everyone thought this would be like in 75-25, and it ended up being 53-47 in favor of it. People will not vote for it if it goes on a ballot. And so the legislators are going to say, we are elected to lead, so we're going to push this through. But I did see an online poll in Racine on their newspaper website asking, did they like this deal or not? And it was 70-20 against, with 10 undecided. Yeah.
All right, so this is a question from Truman Burbank, who apparently is a Jim Carrey fan. I think that was the Truman Show character. He
says,
who is going to be responsible for all ongoing maintenance, repair, replacement costs? And I think this refers to the new arena, as well as potential upgrades. And it, this reader notes, the Bradley Center has, you know, massive amounts of deferred maintenance and things. So who in this deal is responsible?
The owners have decided that they'll take over responsibility for maintenance. And I think that's largely because they see this as a profitable deal. So they're willing to pick that up to ensure that the thing gets done.
Okay. All right. I think that's where we'll leave it. We'll be back next week at the same time, though. It's summer, so we're going to see if maybe we can broadcast from a deck or a river walk.
That would be nice.
Patio or something. That might be kind of cool.
Can we wear flip-flops and stuff?
Well, they're not on this camera. You can wear whatever you want from the bottom down, Dan. All right, we'll see you next week.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.